from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Abigail Tucker says we're in the grip of a cat craze. The internet is packed with cat memes. But just look at the sheer number of house cats, 600 million or so in the world. Tucker says more cats are born in the U.S. every day than there are lions left in the wild. And why? That is, why so many? Why are we so taken by cats when we all know they don't really give that much back? Tucker says despite our obsession with cats, we don't know that much about them. That is, what they are and how they came to live with us. She's joining us today to talk about the cultural and natural history of cats that she's written. And in the book, she explores why we love them and how they became domesticated. Turns out they domesticated themselves, by the way. Figures. Join us after the news.
This Friday on 45 Days, more guns. We'll explore progress on two bills that would alter Utah's concealed carry laws. Also, we'll look at what lawmakers are doing or not doing to help public school teachers. That's 45 Days. Download the next episode on Friday at iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and at KUER.org.
This is Radio West, and Doug Fabrizio. There's got to be a reason there are hundreds of millions of house cats in the world, and their numbers are growing. Well, cats are a remarkably successful species, and the journalist Abigail Tucker says the reason isn't that they're smart or strong. It's because they're adaptable, supremely adaptable. Sure, they're finicky about things like their food, but they're really good, she says, at tweaking their schedules and their social lives. According to Tucker, what they've become best at, though, is navigating a relationship with us. In her book, she explains that cats took the initiative in the relationship with early humans. In effect, she says they domesticated themselves. And so in her book, she explores what that means, because she says the success of the cat has cascading global consequences. Her book is The Lion in the Living Room, How House Cats Tamed Us and Took Over the World. She's joining us today to talk about it. Abigail Tucker was the first ever staff writer for Smithsonian Magazine, where she's still a contributor. She's joining us today from the studios of NPR member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. And Abigail Tucker, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Okay, so let's begin with your sort of, we need to establish your credibility on this subject. because the consequences of all these cats is a big part of the story, but you come at this as a cat person, like a legitimate cat person, right?
Exactly. Yes, I'm from one of these cat-owning, cat-loving families that has never had dogs, had never had a dog as a pet. Cats have been a huge part of my life personally for, you know, farther back than I can remember. And I think, you know, a lot of people can, you know, share that feeling of being a personal expert on cats. And that's one of the things that's made writing this book so interesting. Everybody kind of has their own take on these animals. I sort of began to consider these very familiar creatures in a new light when for Smithsonian, I became a wildlife writer of sorts and began writing and thinking about all kinds of different organisms from jellyfish to red wolves and sort of starting to think about what made these creatures tick. And I had the privilege of writing about some kinds of wild cats and learning about, you know, why a lot of these big cats and other kinds of wild cats aren't doing so well in the world today. And that made me even more curious about why do I have a cat in my house and why are there so many, you know, why are there approaching a billion of these guys running around the earth today?
It's interesting. You mentioned in the book that it was when you became a mother that you really started looking, I don't know if critically is the right way of putting it, but and not, maybe not suspiciously, but you started thinking about it in maybe in different terms.
Yeah, I, you know, I had always been one of these people who was guilty of, you know, thinking of my cat as a sort of surrogate child and babying my cats. And then I think once I actually had human children of my own, I sort of began to think about, you know, the ways that these were not exactly babies and how there were some demands that, you know, my little cats placed upon me. And why had I sort of been under their spell and in their sway for so many years before, you know, having kids of my own. And it wasn't that I started not to like my cats. I just sort of began to think of them, you know, how had they been having this subliminal effect on me for so long that I hadn't really realized until I began to say, hey, these were mothering impulses that I was feeling towards these animals that have no relation to me whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah. And which sort of gets us to the big question in the book, which we'll sort of work through as we go. But it's the question is sort of how it is we've come to expect so little from cats, which is not the case, you point out, with other domestic animals. I mean, we expect dogs to be kind of useful and to be companions. We expect eggs and, you know, meat from chickens and milk from cows and sort of down the line. But cats, they offer companionship for sure, but they're still pretty elusive and pretty solitary. And I guess that's what you're trying to find out. Why have we stuck with them? Because what we get in return isn't all that much.
Yeah, it's really hard when you begin to think about this relationship, which is so familiar and so common, so much part of the fabric of human life today. You know, your relationship with your cat, sort of the more that you think about it, the less sense it makes. And it's just sort of interesting that when you think about why we have many other kinds of there aren't that many domesticated animals, first of all. There's maybe a dozen or two dozen different kinds, and it's obvious why we have cultivated a relationship with these animals, and it's clear that we want something from them. You know, as you say, with a lot of animals, we want to eat or use a part of their body. With dogs, you know, we've used them as beast of burden in many different ways and have almost infinite tasks that we've designed for them. Whereas cats, we don't have exactly a job for them. We don't have a need for any of their physical byproducts. And so that was one of the things that kind of drove me as I was reporting that I had to figure out what it was that made this relationship tick. And you know, I think that it's the answer is something that, you know, it has to do with a particular set of weaknesses that humans have and a particular set of strengths that cats have.
Right.
And, you know, but every time I tried to think of something, you know, okay, here's something that for sure cats furnished for us, it sort of seemed to fall apart a little bit the more I thought about it. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, humans are such users, right? We just take these animals under our wing and then, you know, we just demand so much for them. With cats, you know, I think there's something beautiful about the fact that we tolerate them and indeed adore them without actually getting that payback that we as humans have come to expect from other creatures. And I think that's something that's really kind of wonderful.
You compiled this list of uses for cats. We don't have to spend a lot of time with this, but I thought it was really interesting. I mean, purring is sort of, that seems useful, and that may even, although this seems anecdotal, did you ever find whether or not purring of a cat increased like oxytocin levels or serotonin levels, and like do we respond to that in a physiological way?
You know, I've heard bits and pieces of those arguments, and I'm sure it's possible that it could. I read something about, you know, even purring having some kind of effect on human bone density. Mm-hmm. But again, it just seemed a little thin to me,
right,
that, you know, that we would have these animals around that for so long because, you know, because of purring and, you know, these other kind of marvelous ideas that people had for, you know, things we could do with these cats that were just pouring into our communities. And I think, was it the Chinese who used their pupils to
yeah.
to tell the time of day and other communities that would use these cats to in farming rituals to make it, you know, you'd run your cat around your field and dunk it in a big pool of water in hopes that it would make it rain, and just these kind of very far-fetched, charming repurposing of these little guys that doesn't make that much sense in the light of day, but I think that it shows that we've always been kind of driven to find uses for these animals, and that's true today. I mean, there's really kind of I would love to learn about the use of feline fur in as DNA evidence in murder trials and things like that. These kind of oddball applications that we've dreamt up to make use of cats.
I was really interested in the story that you tell right at the beginning of the book, where you write about this sighting of what people thought was a lion, an actual lion, in Essex, England, where there are no lions. And it turned out sort of wasn't, of course, at all a lion. But it's interesting that people thought it might be. And you say there's this phenomenon known as, I think it's called phantom cat. And it's kind of common in the UK. Would you say something about that? I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. So it's this, these are these things called there's a cryptozoological term for them, that which I believe is ABCs, or alien big cats, which is where people in these places where there are no big cats, like England or, you know, parts of Australia especially, where they'll be these kind of feline apparitions, and people will say, oh, you know, I saw a lion or I saw a tiger. And in the case of the Essex lion, it was interesting because it created a media firestorm, and there were zookeepers running around with dart guns and helicopters with heat-seeking technology looking for this lion, which of course turned out to be somebody's pet cat. And I thought that that was interesting for a bunch of reasons. First, because it points out the close similarities physically between house cats and the rest of the feline family, animals like lions. They look very, very similar except for their scale. And that to me is really interesting because animals like lions and tigers are among the Earth's most in peril today. They do terribly in human-shaped environments and are always kind of at odds with men. And whereas house cats have just flourished in the company of humans, which I think is really interesting. I think it kind of speaks to this idea that part of us can sense that these little furry house cats that we have around are in their own way immensely powerful animals. Now, I wanted to say that we have these ABC sightings in America, too. They can be a little bit different here because in recent years, there's been this trend in sort of highbrow cat breeding of breeding house cats with some of their near relations in the feline family, which are actually wild cats, and creating cats that really do look like leopards and are a little bit bigger than than the cats that we're accustomed to seeing on the ground beside us or on the couch with us. And so it's interesting that that there is some truth sometimes to these sightings, but a lot of times these cats are just have been seen from a distance at a weird angle. A funny photograph is taken, and people's imaginations take off. And also, you know, it's worth saying too that it's hard to overstate the importance of the feline family in sort of the primitive human development. We were shaped very much. Our early human ancestors were shaped very much by big cats as our predators, we were their prey. Yeah. And so I think that that's kind of evident, too, in this way that we can see this very hauntingly familiar shape from a distance and just have this kind of shocked reaction, like, wow, what is that? And we see it with fresh eyes, which I think is interesting.
I want to come back to that, actually. I find that relationship part an important part of the story. Let me ask you, though, you mentioned that purebred, mongrel, barn cat, city cat, alley cat, they're all pretty much the same animal. The only differences are, although I guess in some ways you mentioned that may be changing, but you say the only differences are circumstances and semantics. Say something about that, if you would. And the fact that they haven't really changed physically all that much, which is also really interesting.
Yeah. So basically, this was one of the things that I kind of had to parse for myself as I was trying to consider in an objective way this very familiar animal, which had been a part of my personal life for a long time. Mm-hmm. And basically, these cats are different kinds of cats that we see in different contexts. Like we see a stray cat in a city alleyway, or we hear accounts of feral cats cutting it for themselves in the Australian outback, or then we have our very tame seeming little companions in our houses. And then, of course, there's internet cats, and it's tempting because the context that these cats are in are so wildly different. It's tempting to think of them as distinct animals.
Yeah.
When in fact, they're all exactly the same. And, you know, that's hard to wrap our minds around, that there's no physical difference between pet cat and what we might call a wild cat or a feral cat. It's just the amount of contact they've had with humanity and the way that they make their living. So these cats are all just one kind of, like, for example, to explain to people, my own beloved cat named Cheeto, yeah. I got as basically a sort of community cat, a semi-feral kitten. And, you know, he became the tamest, most, you know, ingratiating of pets. But he had a brother who I wasn't able to adopt at that time. And so this cat was left in the community cat environment, this feral cat environment. And, you know, for all I know, he's off, you know, making his own living in the woods. And that's not because they're different species or something like that. It's just because their relationship with humanity and our resources is different. And so basically, these cats are all different from, the feral cats, stray cats, alley cats, pet cats, whatever you want to call them, are all different from their near relation, their nearest relation, who's still alive and well in the Middle East today, Felis sylvestris libica, who is a bona fide wild animal. And it was the progeny of Felis sylvestris libica about 10,000 years ago who began going down this strange, murky road of domestication. And so all of these cats that we know about, the house cats that appear in these wildly different forms, which are all fundamentally the same, are all domesticated cats. They're not wild. They've undergone a physiological process of domestication, which makes them distinct from, you know, the other 36 or 37 wild members of the feline family. And that's something that, you know, I'd love to talk about more. It's something that scientists are still kind of trying to piece together. What is it that happens to an animal's brain and body and human company that makes them domesticated? Yeah. And cats are interesting because they're like partially domesticated. They haven't fully gone down that road the way things like dogs or cows have.
Yeah, well, I want to come back to that too, because a lot of the like curly tails and floppy ears and mottled coats, like that was one way you could identify a domesticated creature. Cats didn't really do that. Yeah, we'll come back to that and talk a little bit about why. I guess we'll also get to the particulars of this question of cats as an invasive species, but this is one of the points that I imagine disappoints a lot of cat owners and cat lovers, is that they're pretty devastating. I mean, they're an invasive species is what you say. And you say in the book that we can't quite decide where we should stand on cats. Either we love and embrace them, or we're wary of them. We pass laws to control their populations, or even in some cases think of them as vermin. I guess we feel conflicted about them.
Yeah, that's right. We, you know, in figuring out this animal that we have a very close relationship but have never really controlled, you know, a lot of contradictions come up. And there's one thing I talk about in the book where, you know, New York City shut down its subway system or part of it at one point in an effort to save two little feral kittens from the tracks. You know, meanwhile, America engages in the systematic euthanization of many unwanted, you know, millions of unwanted cats per year. And so it's just kind of fascinating that we put this animal on a pedestal in certain public lights, and then sort of behind closed doors, we have another relationship with that animal. And I think it again, is because we struggle to understand what this animal is and what place it should have in our hearts. And, you know, this idea that the house cat is not really dependent on us. It is only a partially domesticated animal that only exhibits some of what we were just talking about, these really oddball, goofy traits that Charles Darwin first identified as the domestication syndrome, which are common across domesticated animals. Things like having a shortened face or floppy ears or curly tails. All these things are signs, are rare in nature. Like Darwin pointed out, that in nature, the only wild animal that has floppy ears is, you know, some certain kinds of elephants. And so this idea of what has shaped this strange looking domestication syndrome, and why don't cats exhibit all of it? And, you know, part of the reason is that people think that because we never intentionally domesticated cats, they just kind of came into our sphere of their own accord and underwent some of these neurological changes on their own, that, you know, cats are only partially domesticated. And that's why they can kind of play it both ways. They can live in our homes, but they can also operate independently in nature as, you know, basically tiny apex predators. And that's why, you know, they can both be a kind of cultural phenomenon and a domestic object that we love to kind of baby and adore, while, you know, in the forests of Australia or in, you know, the forests of Key West here in America or Hawaii, cats are an invasive species that scientists would say is a very big problem. And of course, you know, the fact that cats have a hold on our heartstrings means that dealing with them as an invasive species is also a very tricky thing.
Well, you found that a lot of scientists who, even the scientists who think of cats as kind of this menace, love cats, which seems kind of surprising, because you say, as you say in the book, the clinical side of science doesn't quite match the kind of mystery and elusive nature of cats. But this, a lot of the scientists you talked to must have been conflicted like you. They were kind of cat lovers as well.
Oh, completely. Yeah, I mean, this one scientist who I talked to who had studied the, you know, profound effects that feline arch predators had had on early hominids. You know, he had his own little fuzzball that he loved and had been involved in, I believe, you know, cat leash laws in his own community. He thought that cats should be allowed to run free in his area. There was another scientist who I spent some time with who had done these really interesting studies in the alleyways of Baltimore about the effects of house cats on urban rodent populations. And, you know, we can talk about that more later. Basically, yeah. His take was that cats have little to no effect on curtailing rodent populations whatsoever. And they basically just hang out with these rats in alleyways and gobble trash together. But even though he'd kind of taken, he'd recorded this almost like interspecies treason, the fact that, you know, these cats that are supposed to be killing these rats are just kind of cozying up with them at these dumpsters, he, you know, felt moved to adopt one of the cats from his study animal area, because he thought it was, you know, just such an amazing little presence that he needed to have it in his house. And so I think that, you know, even though there's people who, you know, there's this very kind of hard-hitting debate between especially bird scientists and cat lovers, there's a lot of scientists who are as much in cat's thrall as the rest of us. And I think that that is just more testament to feline power, that, you know, these guys who study the impacts of cats on various populations and other aspects of human life also have, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 cats of their own.
Right. Abigail Tucker is with us. Her book is The Lion in the Living Room, How House Cats Tamed Us and Took Over the World. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about, the history of your cat. And cat lovers are going to feel conflicted about the show, but let's be honest, they're just really tolerating you. In her book, the journalist Abigail Tucker describes cats, uses descriptions who describe them as cryptic and solitary and opportunistic. She's a cat lover, by the way. Cheeto is her current pet, but she admits she's baffled by the connection between humans and felines, and so she explores it in her book called The Lion in the Living Room, How House Cats Tamed Us and Took Over the World. She's joining us today from a studio in Fairfield, Connecticut. Okay, so it seems like in order to really understand the sort of deep relationship, we have to understand cats' diets. They're carnivores, and not just carnivores, they're hyper-carnivores. Like, dogs can get by without meat, but not cats. And I think this is important. I wanted you to say something about this because we were their prey early on, and that's sort of an interesting part of the story.
Yeah, so that's one of the things that I had to kind of teach myself as I was reporting the book, you know, taking this furry fixture of my household, you know, what I would consider in many ways a family member, and kind of breaking this creature down into its elements. And, you know, just what you said, the sort of best way to think of the essence of a house cat is as a solitary, hyper-carnivorous ambush predator. Right. And I found that when I was to consider them in whatever role, as, you know, their role inside of our living rooms, their role as an invasive species, even their presence on the internet, to kind of think of them in those terms was a really clear way to think of what makes them tick and why they act as they do. And, you know, one thing that's important to note is that in nature, a lot of, the vast majority of cats are solitary animals. They don't run into other cats and chat at the watering hole. They don't, they don't socialize. They're by themselves in the wilderness, and they are, you know, very territorial. And, you know, part of that is because cats are very, very much armed to the teeth animals. So it's really dangerous for two cats, even of the same species, to meet in the woods because, you know, they can really do a lot of damage to each other very quickly. But another reason is that, you know, as hypercarnivores, cats need to control these vast tracts of territories to get the meat that they need to survive. And, you know, they don't share well. That's why they're the apex predator at the top of the pyramid. They need to harvest all of this protein for themselves. And that's another thing about them. They're actually wild cats because they are at the very top of the food chain, are actually very fragile animals. If things go wrong further down on the food chain and prey animals disappear, cats are, you know, one of the first things to blink out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we think of ourselves now as these kind of exalted primates who are, you know, spiritual, civilized beings. But, you know, back in the day, and really still in some places in the world, we were just another item on cats' menu, right. Pretty much. We count as meat, too. And if you look, people have looked at the, the amount of that even today on our primate near ancestors, things like baboons and even chimpanzees, cats are still their primary predators in a lot of contexts, and can even kill gorillas and things like that. And it seems like the predation pressure that cats put on us as, you know, just another source of meat was, you know, maybe one of the things that helped shape our species and our social lives and things like that, which I just, you know, that's not really what the book is about. You know, it's not about, you know, big cats and saber-toothed cats back in the day, but it's just another way of showing what intensely powerful animals these are and how, you know, our relationship with them has changed radically in the last 10,000 years or so since basically, you know, back, you know, a few million years ago, lions were the most widely distributed land animals in the world. And today that honor belongs to house cats. And the thing that changed was human agriculture and these new spheres that humans made that allowed house cats to come into our world. And so basically this cozy relationship that we have with cats today is just worlds away from the relationship that we would have had with their wild ancestors. And, you know, obviously one difference is that house cats are small and a lot of these cats that ate us were bigger. But, you know, still we would have been locked in a kind of carnivorous competition, even with smaller cats that would have stolen, you know, chickens from us or competed with us for fish and these other precious meat resources.
So it was like around 10,000 years ago, we started to grow gardens and raise our own herd animals. And this is kind of one of the important points in the book, as you sort of mentioned, cats, wild cats anyway, have been declining ever since that time.
That's right, because these settlements that once we sort of transitioned from being hunter-gatherers to being sedentary people, it changed the world in a lot of ways. Once we started kind of growing our own harvests and raising our own animals and hoarding resources, we had a really big population explosion, which changed our relationship with the landscape completely. And meant that we, you know, we in essence became more territorial. We started claiming more and more of the land that used to belong to wild cats, which were the animals at the top of the food chain. And, you know, they, you know, once we either ate their prey animals or drove them away, they sort of started taking our domestic animals, which we wouldn't tolerate. So we started to exterminate them. So that was kind of doomsday for a lot of feline species. It's not really a stretch to say that, you know, the vast majority of them have, you know, suffered due to the agrarian human lifestyle. But only one has turned it to its complete advantage and made sort of a play for world dominance because of human agriculture, and that would be the house cat, our little household friend.
So how did they become domesticated? As one scientist, Carlos Driscoll, told you, they basically domesticated themselves. But explain how it worked, because you point out in the book, the cats are terrible candidates for domestication. They're finicky. They don't have much in the way of a social life. They're pretty solitary figures. But they did have, you say, one kind of vital domestic quality going for them, and that was their temperament. That they were gutsy. They weren't meek. They were kind of brave. They sort of insinuated themselves on early human civilization. Is that the way to put it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That, you know, I didn't use this word in the book, and I wish I would have. But I think what cats are is they're cool. Yeah. They have a very, you know, they have temperament traits that make them more able to hang out in the human sphere. And that is a trait that I've been told was kind of cultivated within cats over time. Basically, One of the things I did in the book was go to the lab of the Smithsonian scientist who was sorting through the wreckage of this Neolithic site from Turkey called Halamcemi. And she had this big pile of bones there and, you know, basically showed me how humans were having these big feasting parties all the time and leaving these huge mounds of trash around and also killing off top predators who would have been lurking around these early human settlements. And so that combination of taking out big animals that would have eaten small cats, things like leopards and maybe lynx, we were killing those animals off and at the same time leaving huge piles of trash around. And that led to something that she called a mesopredator release, where all these small and mid-sized carnivores started hanging out in our settlements more. And that would have included animals like foxes and certain kinds of badgers and also these little wildcats. And you can see in our cities today that we still have these mesopredator releases. In London, you know, there's a lot of red foxes around. In, you know, I know at my house in Connecticut, there's lots of raccoons and they're still drawn to this kind of umbrella of safety that humans provide and this sort of riches of our trash cans. But what's interesting is that, you know, those animals like foxes and badgers and raccoons never really made it into our world as domesticated animals. And, you know, the best way to kind of think about that is that cats had temperament qualities that, you know, were amplified over time within our settlements as cats were stealing food from us and, you know, making use of our meat resources. And they were gradually, you know, the animals that had already sort of reduced startle systems would have been the ones most likely to come into our settlements. And then they ate more and more food and met other cats that had the same sort of set of temperamental qualities and had babies in which, you know, these qualities would have been amplified even more. And so cats just sort of, you know, cats physically look very much like their relatives, their wild relatives in the Near East, Felis sylvestris libica, but sort of the main physical difference that you can point to other, you know, besides these weird coat markings that you see in certain cats is the reduced size of the cat's brain, the domestic cat's brain, and especially the forebrain, the areas that control fear and flight resource impulses. And so the animals sort of were shaped just by virtue of who got the most food and had the most babies over the centuries. The ones that had the calmest or coolest temperaments kind of prevailed. And I think there's this other thing that kicked in that while, you know, these cats sort of bred themselves to be more cool, calm, and collected in our company, we also gravitated towards them for reasons that have to do with the way cats look. And, you know, features that distinguish them a little bit from some of their peers in the mesopredator pile, things like foxes. I think that cats have an aesthetic appeal to humans that other ones of those animals don't have to the same extent.
What is that about? Is it I can't remember the term used in the book, like references almost like they there's some connection we're making to babies almost.
Yeah, this idea of baby releasers.
Yeah.
This set of neonate-like features that animals, certain animals have. And, you know, that has to do with, you know, having really big round eyes and a little snub nose and a round face, all these things that cats just quite naturally seem to have. And what's interesting is that all those things are really just kind of a distillation of feline hunting prowess. Cats have these really big round eyes in the middle of their heads because they they're ambush predators and they need to kind of hop out at their prey and get have really good depth perception. They have smaller noses than dogs do because they don't, you know, again, they don't sort of snuffle after their prey for miles and miles the way wolves would have done. They were watch and wait predators and then they have these round faces because they have these really short, powerful jaws full of these cutting and slicing type teeth. So this face that to us looks very much like our helpless young is actually the face of a supreme predator. But it's just this sort of accidental parallel between the two images that has such power over us, and that, you know, maybe could have edged cats into our communities a little bit more than some other little furry animals that don't have exactly that killer set of baby releasers that felines do.
But they didn't adapt that look in their face like other domestic, like some domestic animals. We were talking about this earlier. This is something Charles Darwin sort of looked in. They had smaller teeth. They got these splotchy coat pigmentation. They had these so-called juvenile-looking faces. I mean, all this was an adaptation to make themselves more appealing to humans. Cats just sort of had that from the get-go. We found them appealing anyway. They didn't have to adapt.
Exactly. Yeah, you'll see in some of the, especially the smaller kinds of dogs that humans have developed over the years, these faces that look a lot like cat faces.
Yeah.
You know, animal dogs with short noses and big round eyes and this kind of sweet look, and that's something that, you know, is very distinct from the, you know, people don't know when or where or exactly dogs arose or which kind of wolf they came from, but these little dogs look nothing like wolves. Whereas if you took a face of a, you know, your average domestic cat and compared it to the face of this wild relative that we've been talking about in the Near East, Felis sylvestris libica, you know, even experts can't tell the difference between these faces. They look very much the same. And that is just a happy accident of of nature, that this all feline faces have these qualities just due to the particulars of the feline hunting arsenal. The way that their faces are shaped is a reflection of how they hunt. And again, returning to this idea of them being cryptic, solitary, ambush hunters that are hypercarnivores. That's, you know, written all over their faces. And that's something that, you know, to us just resonates for completely different reasons. They look like us and they look like our kids.
Abigail Tucker is with us. Her book is The Lion in the Living Room, How House Cats Tamed Us and Took Over the World. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Abigail Tucker. We're talking about her book, The Lion in the Living Room, How House Cats Tamed Us and Took Over the World. So I wanted to ask you about 600 million now house cats, we think. Numbers growing like exponentially. How much damage are they doing ecologically, house cats?
So that is a very controversial topic. And, you know, I think that the best answer is that in some places they're doing a tremendous amount of damage, especially on islands basically any kind of islands. Cats are devastating introduced predators. And that's because a lot of these islands where cats are able to arrive because of their close relationship with humanity, they invariably arrive on our sailing ships during explorations or even during scientific expeditions. And then once they're entrenched in an environment, because cats are so good at surviving and can hunt almost anything, they just thrive. And islands are exceptional in a couple of ways. A lot of times there's no native predators on these islands. And so some of these birds on these islands can't even fly. They're literally a type of sitting duck in certain cases. And there's on some of these islands, the animals have not been exposed to some of the diseases that cats carry and other things that can really kind of rock an ecosystem. Now, the question gets more complicated when you extrapolate the data from these small islands into bigger areas like the American mainland. And certainly cats are spectacular hunters and hunt all kinds of things in all kinds of environments. But it's tricky to figure out exactly the kind of damage they're doing in such huge areas. Scientists have made some big gains in this regard in recent years by doing things like attaching cameras to cats, which are just basically indoor, outdoor, average suburban house pet type cats, and seeing what they're hunting. And, you know, they're hunting a lot of things, and a lot of things that they don't bring home necessarily to their masters to assess. But people on the other side will say, but, you know, even so, it's not the sort of, this isn't a nightmare scenario for the American mainland. I think a really interesting middle ground to contemplate is Australia, which is an island, but also a continent. And in Australia, house cats have been described by sort of the local scientists there as, in some cases, a bigger threat to mammalian life than global warming or even habitat loss. That these cats, which are kind of burrowed into the outback and making a living everywhere from, you know, these tropical forests to the deserts, that they have been intimately involved in the extinction of a lot of different kinds of animals in Australia. And so Australia, again, is exceptional because it's not a place that has any native feline species. And so cats are a unique presence there in ways that they're not on the American mainland, where we do have animals like lynx and cougars, which are indigenous. But it's still kind of shocking to see the damage that they can do to a continent, not just an island. So, you know, I think of that as something that, you know, it's a sad story, because it's a way to think of, you know, the way that humans have influenced the world without even trying. We've kind of taken up with this cute little furball animal, and then lo and behold, it's unleashed hell in these various environments. But I also think that it's something that, you know, it almost helps you think of the house cat as more of a marvelous organism than just this kind of little infant-esque creature that hangs out with you on the end of your bed. It's a way to show how powerful this little creature that's often dismissed is, that it's, you know, it can still have a stranglehold on nature and get by on its own without human help. And that's just one of these fascinating things about house cats, that they can take us or leave us. They kind of use us to get where they're going, and then they can just kind of take off. And I just was fascinated by these stories that I found in some colonial journals and things like that of these initial house cat introductions, and how these cats just kind of disappeared into the outback, you know, never to be seen again. And then also, you know, the arrival of some of these house cats on islands which had native human populations that had never seen house cats before, and how struck these native peoples were by the feline form that they'd never imagined existed before.
Well, I think this is a big theme in the book. And you say later on that these cats are sort of they're the crucible in which we form our thoughts about the fading natural world. Pets, you say, are the sort of that crucible. And you say you want us to see the cat not as just this plaything, but as a powerful organism with a strategy and a story. So I guess that gets at what you were saying, is we need to stop thinking about them as just these sort of playful pets and think about them as having a sort of powerful natural inclination that we need to at least know about, I guess.
Exactly. Yes. I think especially when we're operating more and more in this world where, you know, we're living on computers and we're living in cities. And that's another kind of interesting thing about the house cat's ongoing conquest of the world, that the formation of human cities and the fact that more than half of the globe's population lives in cities now, that's just been a boon to house cats, because we kind of prefer them as pets to dogs in a lot of these urban contexts. And more pet cats means more alley cats and stray cats. And it's just kind of feeds into the success story of these animals. But I think that, you know, as we experience the natural world more and more through these animals, which are hermetically sealed in our bedrooms, in our living rooms, or even worse, online, where it's just like we see these cute little cats and laugh at their antics, but we don't wonder about, well, how on earth did this creature get inside my house, let alone inside of my computer? I think that that's sort of a dangerous way to go about living, and sort of a boring one, too. And I think that, you know, to me, you know, you have these with cats, they arouse such passions in people on both sides. You know, I think partially because they do have this human look, it's easy to sort of vilify them or make them into little angels. But I think it's important to sort of talk about, you know, why, you know, why they have such power over us, and to consider the complications of what it means to have created quite by accident this kind of domestic animal that we never meant to have around us and then have just sort of unleashed on the planet.
What did you learn about, there's a whole sequence where you write about, you know, these cat videos, which... I like how you put it in the book. You say these cat videos, which are everywhere, of course, these are just another way in which cats have manipulated us. They've entirely transcended the flesh, and now they're in our television screens. What did you learn about cats and cat content on the internet? I mean, you know, what did you learn about that?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that this was just another extension of cats' invasive capabilities. You know, they invaded the first human settlements. Mm-hmm. They invaded all kinds of islands worldwide. They invaded our homes and bedrooms, and now they're inside of our computers. And I think, you know, to sort of contemplate this bizarre phenomenon of cat memes and cat videos, I did the same thing that I tried to do in a lot of other parts of the book, which is just take cats at their essence and that say that, you know, these are what about these videos it shows the sort of asocial, hyper carnivorous nature of cats. And I think that, you know, a lot of the things that we see in cat videos that makes us smile or you know, or hit share or whatever are hunting behaviors, which are something that, you know, the most natural kind of effortless parts of cats, what they do best. They have, you know, as ambush predators, cats are very hidden animals that kind of explode out to get things. So they have this really funny, jerky way, a sudden way of moving. And that's a lot of what you see in cat videos. It's just cats popping out from weird places, jumping into boxes or out of boxes, and demonstrating this sort of core hunting behaviors. Another thing that's interesting is, you know, their... the way that they're the combination of their human-like features and then their expressive emptiness. Cats are not visually expressive animals at all, because in nature, as we talked about, they don't see other cats or communicate with them except by leaving smells in different places on trees and scratching trunks and things like that. So they don't express visually. And so there's something about this human-like face that's also a perfect blank. Is really kind of compelling to us. And then, of course, there's just the sheer fact that with so many millions, approaching 1 billion house cats on the planet today, there's just a lot more opportunities to make funny cat videos. Like there was a funny panda video site at one point, which failed badly. And that's because, you know, pandas are highly endangered animals that only live in the bamboo forests of China. So it's a lot harder to get a good video of a panda, whereas cats are all around us. And then there's this other thing that, you know, in the last 30 to 40 years or so, we've been keeping a lot more of our cats indoors constantly. And even though cats have historically been these cryptic animals, which are hard to see and very hidden in nature, since we started keeping them in our houses, we have a lot more access to them and a greater ability to photograph and film them that we've never had before in our history with feline kind. There is a great book written recently called The Photographed Cat, which is about sort of historic photographs of cats in the early 1900s and how people tried really hard to take cat pictures, but it was impossible because cats lived most of their life outdoors. But today that's changed.
Wow. Abigail Tucker, her book is The Lion in the Living Room, How House Cats Tamed Us and Took Over the World. She joined us from a radio station, WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Abigail Tucker, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.